Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Nearing the end of the Geminid meteor shower. Our AccuWindow forecast is 48 degrees clear outside. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. We want you to be part of the program. Our call-in number anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. And anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. Or you can reach us through Skype at BBS Radio 2. The number 2, BBS Radio 2. And we have another way that BBS Radio has provided us to be part of the program. And that is you can call in our conference line, which is 805-399-1000. 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608-POUND. 769-608-POUND. Now, you won't be able to talk to us, but you'll be able to listen to us on your cell phone. Lots going on tonight. We have, as our guest tonight, Dr. Hilde. Many of you know her from her radio program that's out there. She's going to be coming on at 5:30 Pacific time. I did want to let you know the solar wind has picked up. You know, it's been kind of quiet out there, like a gentle breeze. But it has picked up to 409 kilometers per second. And the proton density is up to 8.0 per cubic centimeter. There are 5 very wimpy sunspots close to the western and eastern limbs of the sun right now, so all is well. No worries about geomagnetic storms. Things are so calm, in fact, 5 days before the end of the Mayan calendar, that NASA is so sure the world won't come to an end, they have already released this news item for the day after. It's dated December 22nd, 2012, probably because most of them have left early for their Christmas vacation. But the headline is, if you're reading this story, it means one thing. The world didn't end yesterday. According to media reports of an ancient Maya prophecy, the world was supposed to be destroyed on December 21st, 2012. Where the heck did they get that? Not from this radio program. Anyway, apparently not. Quote, the whole thing was a misconception from the very beginning, says Dr. John Carlson, director of the Center for Archaeoastronomy. The Maya calendar did not end on December 22nd, 2012, and there were no Maya prophecies foretelling the end of the world on that date. On that part, Dr. Carlson is correct. It was just the new beginning. It was just the end of the age of Pisces and the beginning of the age of Aquarius. It was all the other sources, like the Bible. You remember Jesus saying what would happen at the end of the age. I say this with some authority because we wrote 2,000 pages on the subject over a series of 4 volumes in the Ark of Millions of Years. If you would like to read what is now history, And I doubt you can finish it in 5 days, but it will prepare you for what is coming. And it's just going to peak at that time. There'll be effects for the next year and a half to 2 years. You can pick it up at arcofmillionsofyears.com or Amazon, Barnes & Noble. But, of course, if you buy it at our website, you get the audio version of the first two volumes, which are the largest books, for free. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. Carlson, Dr. Carlson, is a hard-nosed scientist, by the way, a radio astronomer who earned his degree studying distant galaxies. That sounds exciting in a kind of L. Woods sort of way. He became interested in the 2012 phenomenon in the early 70s when he attended a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and learned about the lost civilization of the Maya. Where the rainforests of Mesoamerica now stand, a great civilization once flourished. The people of Maya society built vast cities, ornate temples, and towering pyramids. And at its peak, around 800 AD, the population numbered more than 2,000 people per square mile in the cities, comparable to modern Los Angeles County, which means they had central plumbing, although it wasn't going into everybody's house. They did have it coursing through the city in a very clean manner, and they didn't use it for a sewer. And they also had, of course, mastered architecture and astronomy and a very elaborate written language. And they left behind exquisite artifacts even after the Spaniards had pillaged nearly everything. There are dates and time references that are quite amazing. Most compelling to Carlson was the Maya expansive sense of time. The times Mayas used dwarf any time scales currently used by modern astronomers, he explains. According to our science, the Big Bang occurred 13.7 billion years ago. The Maya ruins indicate time references stretching back a billion billion times farther than that. The Maya long count calendar was designed to keep track of such long intervals. It is the most complex calendar system ever deployed by any people anywhere. And as we have said many times on this program, it is the only calendar on Earth not based on religion. Written using modern typography, the long count calendar resembles the odometer in a car. It's a modified base 20 system in which rotating digits represent powers of 20 days. Because the digits rotate, the calendar can roll over and repeat itself. This repetition is key to the 2012 phenomenon. So as you see, like Guhathakurta, head of NASA's Living with a Star program, says the sun is not a threat either. The sun has been flaring for billions of years, long before the Maya even existed, and it has never once destroyed the world. Right now, the sun is approaching the maximum of its 11-year activity cycle, and she adds, but this is the wimpiest solar cycle of the past 50 years. It might just be the calm before the storm. If we could time warp a Maya to the present day, they would say that December 21st, 2012 is a very important date. Many Maya believe that their gods who created the world 5,125 years ago would return. One of them in particular, an enigmatic deity named Bolan Yoktek-U, would conduct old rites of passage to set space and time in order and to regenerate the cosmos. The world would be refreshed, not destroyed. I've been waiting to experience this day for more than 30 years, she says. In the meantime, modern science is, of course, looking out. By the way, if you've just joined us, I want to give a shout-out to my friends at Truth Frequency Network, Chris Geo and his crew. They're rebroadcasting this program tonight live. Our call-in number 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America. Also, Dr. Hildy is coming on in about 15 minutes. We're going to bring her on. We have lots of very cool stuff to talk about with her. She is the author of the Hazardous Materials Handbook. I know. You think, wow, really exciting reading. But do you have any idea how long it takes to put a book that size together? This is no small work. It is a standard work that we use in industry, along with our Right to Know programs. And Dr. Hildy has her own talk radio program where she discusses many of the things that have to do with toxicology, and many of the pharmacology, post-human, transhuman, parahuman things that are going on out there. And we're going to discuss a lot of that. It's nice to have an authority on to make this discussion with. So we're glad that you're able to join us at 5:30 Pacific time. Also, I know if you're trying to make some last-minute shopping out there for Christmas, one thing that I have urged you to do is to invest in food. Contact our favorite affiliate, which is the Food Investor. Go to X-Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. Go to the top of the right-hand side of the page, and you'll see the banner for the Food Investor. This food is delicious. It has no preservatives in it. It will last for 30 years. So if you buy it, you put it in a backpack by the front door or in a escape place in the garage where you can grab it and go, a 72-hour kit, or you can get up to several years' supply for you and your family and friends. Now that is a gift that says I love you. That's something you really want to give out. Don't rely on FEMA to bring you your cookies and cocoa and a warm blanket. You're going to get a bandana and some watered down, Carnation Instant cocoa, and that's about it. Just ask the people up in New Jersey how FEMA is doing. Take care of yourself. Contact the Food Investor at x2-radio.com. In modern science, we are ever looking out into space, and there are a couple of programs that are of interest. One is a China probe, which is quite impressive what they've been able to accomplish. Asteroid Tau Tatis, as you know, just passed by us. China official news agency is reporting that the country's Chang'e 2 deep space probe made an amazing flyby of the asteroid Tau Tatis this week, snapping a series of pictures as it passed by at a distance of, get this, 2 miles. Not 20, not 200, not 2,000. This thing is 200,000 miles out there, and they got within 2 miles of it, an asteroid. The achievement signals China's entry into yet another exclusive space club. Only 4 of the world's space efforts have managed close encounters with asteroids. NASA, with near Shoemaker and Dawn, for example. The European Space Agency with Rosetta, Japan with Hayabusa, and now China with Tau Tatis. But this is definitely the closest. The official Xinhua News Agency quoted officials at the State Administration of Science, Technology, and Industry for National Defense, or SASTIND, as saying that Chang'e 2 buzzed past the 3-mile-long asteroid at a relative speed of 24,000 miles per hour. Chang'e 2 was launched in 2010, primarily to serve as a lunar orbiter, but after a successful mission on the moon, as we talked about in this program, the $132 million spacecraft was repurposed as a deep space explorer. So it took off early this year to head out into deep space, and the encounter with Tau Tatis has been planned for months, but Chinese media kept mum about the results until Saturday. Aficionados of planetary science hailed China's success. To quote the Planetary Society's Emily Lakdawala, she said in a blog, "Oh my goodness, did they succeed? This is awesome. Welcome to the Interplanetary Club, China." Tautatus is a near-Earth object that's big enough to cause a mass extinction if it hit our planet, but fortunately, it isn't going to come all that near in the foreseeable future. This week it passed by Earth at a minimum distance, not 200,000 miles, 4.3 million miles, that provided scientists with an opportunity to study the peanut-shaped space mountain at a relatively close but safe distance. Also, NASA's Cassini spacecraft, we know this spacecraft that's been out there a long time, it has captured a very crisp image of a long river cutting across Saturn's huge moon, Titan. The hydrocarbon-filled river stretches more than 250 miles from its source to a large sea near frigid Titan's North Pole. Cassini's radar image is the first high-resolution shot ever taken of such a vast river on a world beyond Earth. Though there are some short local meanders, the relative straightness of the river valley suggests it follows the trace of at least one fault, so it does have some tectonic activity. According to Jani Radabaugh, a Cassini radar team associate at Brigham Young University, such faults, fractures in Titan's bedrock, may not imply plate tectonics like on Earth, but still leading to the opening of basins and perhaps to the formation of the giant seas themselves. I find it most interesting. The radar image provided by Cassini provides another fantastic snapshot of a world in motion. And I'm amazed by it. You know, Cassini is still going strong, and its mission to study Saturn and its moons has been extended through at least 2017. The last image was of a crowd of, this Huyans probe that they landed on Titan. Let's see. It was launched in 97, arrived at the moon in 2004. And it's called the, it's pronounced WHEN, but it's H-U-Y-G-E-N-S, down to Titan's surface. It landed in 2005, and as expected, nevertheless very strangely, WHEN's ceased sending data home shortly after landing on Titan, which at 3,200 miles wide is Saturn's largest moon. Cassini's still going strong. The last image that came from WHEN's was of a crowd of blue beings with long bows running across the meadow of neon green plants toward the camera lens. No, I'm just kidding about that. Just kidding. James Cameron movie did have flowing rivers of methane with methane-laden air, and that's why only the avatars could breathe on the surface. Everyone else had to have breathing apparatus. So in about 9 minutes, we have Dr. Hilde coming on. She is the author of the Hazardous Materials Handbook, which is a standard reference for all industrial right-to-know programs. She is also a talk show host in her own right at 1, that's the number 1, Cell One Light, that's like C-E-L-L, and then 1, O-N-E, and then Light, LIGHT.com, onecelllight.com. And I rarely bring guests on X Squared Radio unless they are the absolute top of their field, and Dr. Hilde is definitely that. And she'll be joining us in about 8 minutes. So I wanted to talk to you about a couple of other things that are in the news. Our hearts go out to the parents of the children involved in the Newton event, as we've read about on the news. No, I'm not going to cover that. Not even the conspiracy theories that are out there talking about it. The only thing that I found strange was that the photograph of the boy that was allegedly the shooter had a strange resemblance, and I make no fun of this, no light or frivolity of this at all, a strange resemblance in the eyes of the shooter in the Colorado event during the same movie of The Dark Knight. Yes, in The Dark Knight, you'll remember in a scene in the movie, I believe it was an hour and 58 minutes into the movie, They are looking at a map of a school, and it's the same school. Just a coincidence with a dark night and another strange anomalous shooting. And again, my heart goes out to those victims. This is a senseless thing that happens almost 24 hours or less than 24 hours later, a similar event in China, except nobody can possess firearms. So the shooter was a knifer and went through the school and slashed 20 students. We don't know of any fatalities. Very little news coming out about that. Just some very strange criminal perpetrations going out there, on out there. And we're going to talk about a lot of what you would consider leading edge subjects tonight. We're going to talk about genetically modified foods. We're going to talk about pharmacology. We're going to talk about the whole subject of transhumanism, parahumanism that's going on out there on several different levels, not just the technological level or the drug level, but also the DNA level. What's going on? Who's doing it? Who's in charge of it? Who gets the benefits of it? And of course, who doesn't? So she'll be joining us in about 5 minutes. Also want to let you know that our phones are open. We did try to do the video tonight. Comcrap is not really cooperating with us tonight. Not enough bandwidth to run the video. I was all dressed up and ready to be on the video with you, but the internet is not behaving itself. So we'll continue to try to bring that technology to you. One of our ideas for 2012 is to bring you a virtually live and interactive news service so that if you see something out there or you have something that you want to send us, a short video clip, a short audio clip, something like that, we can put it on right away. And that way the audience is interactive with the news. It's not been done before, and we think that it would bring a good quality, since we have about 40 million reporters out there with smartphones that are able to grab news from all over the world and send it right here to X Squared Radio, and we can talk about it. So that's some of the changes coming to you in 2013. Also wanted to let you know, last minute, if you wanted to buy a book, we have I have two that are the most recent ones, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. That is, regardless of the title, actually a self-help book. It's designed to teach you how to access the wealth and the energy of the universe and make it your own. And the other is Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. As you know, the election came out exactly the way we predicted in the foreword of the book. Make no bones about it, that the election was not foreseen, but I'm going to say it was foreplanned. And it didn't surprise anyone, except maybe those who had a strange idea that by some hook or crook they would be able to pull out this election. Nothing could be further from any possibility. However, that doesn't mean that the Republic is lost. The Republic is actually in good hands in the fact that we have 50 states in which the now currently unrepresented public lives. And so, as it turns out, there are 40 governors who have signed into law sovereignty acts. And yes, these are very something similar to nullification. And as you have heard in the news lately, the term nullification has come up. In a Civil War sense, it was used by states to declare that they would not obey federal law unless it was ratified by the state legislature, one state at a time. And of course, what was it? Andrew Jackson said, shoot the first nullifier and hang the rest. And, of course, they didn't shoot Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin or other people who decided to act against federal law from time to time. And now we are in a position where the federal government is gone well beyond its charter of controlling the commerce between states and between the United States and other countries. And it has started ruling instead of governing. And so many of the states are bristling at some of those rules that are being handed down to grab more and more of the revenue of its citizens, each individual state. And so they have declared their sovereignty, which is not really a legal standing. It's more of a thumb in the eye situation. But in the Constitution, and this is what the book Alienated Nation is all about, there is a clause that allows the states, three quarters of them, to get together and call a constitutional convention. Now, in a congressional constitutional convention, it's kind of a free-for-all. And if it wasn't for the brilliant work of James Madison, the first one would have been a fall-de-all and probably would have ended the republic right there. But fortunately, he was a very brilliant, very organized man and happened to be first at the convention when it was called. And so everybody respected his structure that he had put together, and that's how the convention went. But that's with a whole lot of representatives from all different states with their own ideas. This would be a very controlled, very Athenian kind of convention where 40 states would come together, literally repeal amendments, pass amendments, and be done in a weekend. And then the Supreme Court would be empowered to take the agency government that was set up in 1932 and has been operating with impunity for 80 years, which has taken over our country, has empowered itself to tax, has empowered itself to levy fines and to seize property, has the ability to write regulations, and we have no representation in that government. We have no congressmen. We have no senators, because that government, that agency government, all the departments, bureaus, agencies, and administrations are all run by bureaucrats. They're not elected. And the leaders of those organizations are appointed by none other than the president himself. They're called the cabinet, the secretaries, the enigmatic secretaries. They work for and follow exclusively the president. Yes, there is advice and consent most of the time. As you know, Ambassador Rice was recently harangued until she gave up being a candidate for Secretary of State. And now that's going to be John Kerry. Sorry, I had to clear some garbage out of my throat there. And the Senate, you know, of course, is involved in that process. However, while the Senate was in session recently, this year, the president appointed two cabinet members, cabinet positions, and did so unilaterally. No advice, no consent, no approval, and those people are still serving. Now, that is a definite violation of the Constitution, but who is going to do anything about it? Nobody. Well, that's what's going on once you get past the secretary's desk, all throughout the administrations, bureaus, departments, agencies, etc. All of these regulations, sometimes there are hundreds a month and sometimes there are thousands a month. One by one, they are passed using court cases as precedents, suing one business after another and winning those cases very strategically, very methodically, to build a legal case, to build a set of regulations that gives the agency government complete and total control over all commerce, all business, all monetary transactions, all trading, all imports, all exports, all communications throughout the United States. Well, those states are sick and tired of it, and they want to take the agency government apart. They want to return the republic to Congress. They want to take the federal government out of the business of ruling the country and put it back into business governing the country. There's a big difference, and we lost sight of that a long time ago. The states have it in their power to do it. You have it in your power to make the states do it. The book Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, it is available at alienatednation.com. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere where you can buy books online. No, it's not available in the bookstores because I don't pay the $1,000 a year book insurance that it requires to put it on the shelf in those stores. If you don't pay that insurance, you're not getting on the shelf. Simple as that. Doesn't matter because online sales are way more than bookshelf sales anyway. All we need is for you to read the book and then tell a friend about it and then send your governor a copy of the book. Yes, I could send the governor a book, but it's much more impressive if you all send the books by the dozens, by the hundreds to your state house. Get your legislators to read it. Get your governor to read it. Go and read excerpts from it at your state house. You can do that. At your city council meetings, you can do that. The idea is to get the states to stand up for themselves. No, not in a civil war kind of way, but in a constitutional way. Stand up united. 40 states can do this because 3/4 of the states can call the convention. And 80% of the states can, which is 40, 75% of the states minimum, can ratify it, which means you can draft the amendments, pass the amendments, and ratify the amendments in one weekend. Done. And then the Supreme Court is empowered to take care of business. You have the control of Congress and the Supreme Court on your side, you can take the executive branch apart and put it back together the way it should be. We're still trying to reach Dr. Hilde. Her aide, her name is Shoshana, very interesting lady, gave me her number, and I passed it along to our producer. Let me just double-check her email really quick. Here we go. I'm going to give a number to my producer here. Just give me a second here to pull this up. Oh, wait a minute. He's just sent me. Okay. Here we go. No, I'm not giving you the number. I'm giving my producer the number. There we go. All right. And her radio program is onecelllightradio.wordpress.com. That is O-N-E-C-E-L-L-O-N-E light, L-I-G-H-T, radio. One cell, one light radio dot wordpress.com. I'll put the link on the website at under x2-radio.com so you all can get there. And she's also at Blog Talk Radio, One Cell, One Light Radio. And she'll be on here in just a minute. We'll see. All right. Hilde is with us. Dr. Hilde, how are you?
I am fine, Dr. Brooks. I appreciate you having me on the show, and we can discuss whatever you would like to discuss with me. And you mentioned earlier the link to our radio. And it's one cell one light radio dot wordpress. The other dot com that you gave out is for our corporate website. And I appreciate everything that you're doing.
Well, we'll make sure to get all the contact information right and get it all out there. And my appreciation is mutual. Anybody that gets on the radio and is out there taking calls and talking to people and spreading the word is really, you know, they're taking a professional risk. You know, we have long reputations that we have built in our industries, you in the toxicology industry, me in the quality engineering and manufacturing engineering industries. But when we get on the air, we're kind of exposed. We're out there. We're talking about things on the fringe of consciousness. And I appreciate your courage and your professionalism for doing that.
Thank you very much. It's quite different dancing on the razor's edge sometimes. You just don't want to get cut, you know?
Yeah, it's the razor's edge between two dimensions sometimes. By the way, I have a copy of the Handbook of Hazardous Materials.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
I hope from a long time ago when it was cheaper. Now it's like, well, past the price of what it was when it came out with Lewis Publishers years ago before CRC bought it, you know, bought the publishing company.
Right. Now it's a thick paper book everybody has in their right to know programs.
Right. It went very well. It was came out in 1984. It's still used to this day. It was a definitive guide. And at the same time, I had the great honor when OSHA put it into their reference book for revising the Federal Right to Know Act, which was the Hazard Communication Standard, 1910-1200, the Right to Know Act.
Wow. Amazing. I mean, that's something that's just widespread everywhere. I don't know if the listeners do that. Unless you're in industry, you probably haven't seen one. But it's necessary because a lot of people don't know the hazardous chemicals and materials that you handle every day in industry, for sure. But even around the house, you know, the stuff under your sink is pretty bad.
Yes, it is. They even came out years ago. This was about 20 years ago. FEMA came out with the Citizens Right to Know course, where you could take a number of their FEMA courses free, independent study, or now they have them online. But they were among the first to put, you know, like a right to know out for people in the home. But the chemicals that can be in the home can be just as deadly as what's in the workplace. And what was good about that book, and anyone that had it, was that I wanted, when I made the book or wrote the book, I wanted a document or a book that had everything in it, because you could be in the field and you needed one reference guide, versus this was before the use of computers in the field and laptops and everything like that.
Absolutely.
It had everything there, the respirators, how to pick out which glove to use. And what I loved in the back, I don't know if you got to see it, Dr. Brooks, was I had a graduate student when I was doing working at the University of Central Florida years ago for their internship with industry. And at that time I was at Martin Marietta, and we had graduate students come that were completing their Master's of Public Health. So they would do an internship with me for a whole quarter or a semester. And it was their practicum, so they got, those graduates got actual workplace exposure of, excuse me, not of the chemicals, but what actually to do in the field, applied their knowledge. And I had the graduate student was Janet McLeod, and she wrote, took all of the chemicals that you could only breathe it in 10 minutes, and you would get the disease of cancer in 10 years, 20 years, later, and that has that appendix in the back of that book. And I've always appreciated her work for doing that, and I was so honored that she allowed me to put it in my book.
Well, it's great research, and it's a great reference for anybody, not just around the home, but definitely in the workplace. You know, I've built biodiesel plants where we're using methanol and sodium methylate, and these are bad players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is methanol we've used in a lab, you know, since I was a teenager to remove,
yes,
you know, permanent markers from glass, for one thing. But if you breathe it in, even though it's somewhat odorless, it does have an effect on your heart. A lot of
right.
people don't know that.
Right. And many of the alcohols, meaning one is ethanol, which you would drink, but the methanols, the isopropyls, any of those they enhance your immune system. In other words, stimulate it so that it will be more reactive to what other chemicals that you're being exposed to. So it enhances it for the other chemical that might be more toxic to become the initiator of whatever disease pattern that you may have. If not taken correct, you know, not doing everything right.
Well, we're going to talk about some very interesting stuff tonight. Of course, I've had some great conversations with your assistant, Shoshana. She's just been fantastic at giving me some reference material to go over tonight, and I've done some more research on my own. And I got to tell you, some of this stuff sounds like conspiracy theory, but it is not. It is very real. And one of the things we're going to talk about, of course, is what's going on with the vaccination program and pharmacology. We're going to talk a little bit about chemtrails. I'm not a big chemtrail person, but certainly some chemicals being administered to the public in a broadcast way is going on out there. Maybe Dr. Hilde knows something about that. We can talk to her about that. But, you know, one of the things that you and I have heard often is the public described as sheeple, that we're just asleep. We're kind of, you know, following the goat to the pasture and then, you know, back to the corral each evening. And Shoshana sent me the most perfect clip from the movie Ants. I'm sure if you've watched it with your kids, you might remember this clip. It's basically where the grasshoppers are talking about a recent encounter with a single ant. I'm going to play it for you just to kind of set the tone of what we're going to talk about tonight. I think you'll enjoy it. Let's see how it goes.
There was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah.
Puny. Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
So that's basically what we're talking about here. We have a public that is about to be informed, about to be enlightened, about to be made aware of what's going on around us. And one by one, they're going to start standing up to the forces that are exposing the public to these kinds of rules and regulations and effects and chemicals and changes they're trying to make to our individual bodies. And when that happens, their way of life is over. So I'm sure you're aware of this. In 2011, the Obama administration proposed revising rules concerning the Freedom of Information Act to allow federal agencies to conceal information requested or to even fabricate information or deny the information that does exist to keep citizens, advocates, and journalists from knowing the truth. And this action becomes pertinent. The reason they did it is after investigations into vaccines. And the UK government's vaccine committees led to exposure of the scheme to keep parents ignorant about the dangers of inoculations for the sake of keeping children on a regular schedule of vaccines, which is leading to the development of neurological disorders and death. In the report entitled The Vaccination Policy and the Code of Practice of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, They explained the deliberate concealment of information from parents for the sole purpose of getting them to comply with an official vaccination. So my question is, you're familiar with the vaccination program, and of course, you know, we're exposed to influx of occurrences of autoimmune diseases, foreign protein particles, mercury, aluminum, formaldehyde, laundry detergent, and there are over 2 million serious reactions to these vaccines yearly. There are 100,000 deaths yearly. ADRs, they're called, is the fourth leading cause of death ahead of pulmonary disease, diabetes, AIDS, pneumonia, accidents, and automobile deaths. So a lot of people don't know nursing home patients have an ADR rate of nearly 350,000 a year. So what is your opinion about the vaccination program? Is it wise? Is it one size fits all? Vaccines made in Taiwan are okay for your kids in Kalamazoo? I think you can connect your line again. We were getting a little bit of an echo there while I was running the video, but now it's over, so we can bring her back on. Is she there? Well,
I'm here.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to know if you'd heard anything about vaccinations. And
yes. Yes, I've heard a lot about vaccinations, and I've evaluated individuals that had a history of vaccinations, and even now there's over-vaccination of children, meaning by the time you're age approximately 4 years old, you've gone through 30 vaccinations. And the new vaccines, meaning I'm talking old vaccines, meaning like tetanus, et cetera, this way, but all of the vaccines are even getting augmented, as you stated, with protein particles, and these protein particles could even be mesogens that are layered, which is the use of bioscaffolding, where they use a polymer so it can unfold and make a new, not new compound, but a new delivery system, and even the nanoparticles that are found now to be toxic. And the difference, too, years ago from Europe versus America, meaning the United States, is that Europe would use heat-killed materials, the pathogens, versus over here we would use live. And also now they're using vaccines of live DNA of whatever the organism is that they're vaccinating against. And in certain countries in Europe, in the northern end, like Denmark and that, they Norway, they were using vaccines, live DNA, in animals, meaning like chickens, cows, pigs, animals that you would eat. And then the question is, do those vaccines transfer to you as you eat that product?
Well, I've noticed, like, for instance, we're very familiar with a flu vaccine for adults. Sometimes we get a particularly nasty flu that's coming along, like the swine flu or bird flu or H1N1. And the vaccines are designed to attack the virulent side of the flu virus. That's the part that mutates from year to year, because you got to remember, gazillion trillions of these things are dividing and using all kinds of hosts to make themselves. And that leads to all kinds of mutations.
Well, not only mutations, but also the introduction to, I'm going to say, foreign organisms' DNA and how it's going to respond to you. Because normally our body is geared for any foreign DNA that comes in to kill it, go after it, engulf it with our immune system, you know, meaning the white blood cells. But some of these newer vaccines that are designed where they're coated in a polymer so that it's like stealth. It goes in or delivers the vaccine right into your own DNA, And thus it tricks the cell so you don't even respond to it outside of whatever it's going to do to your DNA.
Now, when we're talking about DNA changes, when the macrophage goes, the macrophage is like a little spaceship. It holds the genetic material of the virus, which is either a very incredibly advanced life form, a very simple life form. We haven't figured it out yet. But the macrophage attaches itself to the cell like a lunar lander, and then the macrophage injects the genetic material into the cell. The cell now becomes the new factory to make more DNA. Are you saying that that DNA can actually make a change to the DNA of that cell?
Yes, yes. That as you described it as the macrophage, it can also be a bacteriophage, and it can also be called what they call viral protein envelopes, which is just the outside DNA protein of the, not DNA protein, but the protein of the membrane of like an Epstein-Barr virus, and then use like a cytomegalovirus tail to inject it into the cell. And this is all in the new field of gene therapy.
Right, right.
All paid by Medicare, that and nano delivery systems.
Right. And let's talk a little bit about both of those, gene therapy and nano delivery systems. What we've been talking about are protein constructions that are both a combination of natural and artificial, like she was saying, and they inject the live virus in you that's toned down a little bit so that you'll build antibodies against it. So when you're exposed to the real live virus, you already have antibodies in your system, and either you don't get it very badly or you don't get it at all. You'll get a mild version of the flu instead of the full-on, full-blown version of the flu. But
I want to share with you, Dr. Brooks, I agree with what you said, but I disagree with the this portion. I had an individual that was a nurse. She was trained, had to get a vaccine, which was the measles vaccine, because she never had the measles, and ended up being a pure DNA vaccine of the measles. And when she crossed my path where I was testing her because she was chemically exposed to a contaminated site, we're looking for regular chemicals. I also look for different childhood viruses that you may be exposed to. And in this, that's why she got tested for measles. She came back so high from the measles vaccine that the health department contacted our office and wanted to know if she had measles.
Wow.
And we had to, you know, tell, you know, the story and show the vaccine.
So she wasn't showing symptoms of measles, but she was carrying the virus.
She was carrying the virus. Pure. She was four times an acceptable value.
So she was a walking bioweapon. If she'd have walked into an area of unvaccinated people, she would have infected everybody.
Possibly, but she had no symptoms, no nothing. But it was that portion of, meaning whatever that those new vaccines are that they were doing for measles. Like when you and I probably got vaccinated when we were kids, they would do any of that.
I actually got the measles.
I got the measles too. I got the chicken pox. I got all of those.
Yep. We used to have what was it, chicken pox parties where you would take your kid over and get them exposed so they'd get chicken pox. I guess nobody thought that later in life they would have the virus that would give them shingles, but that's what we thought in those days.
Right. And that's because it's embedded itself into the nervous system. And when your not only immune system, but when your enzymes like lysine, in particular like glutathione, or you lose a little sulfur to make the glutathione work, when you lose that because you might be bombarded with other chemicals or that, it comes out, especially when you're under stress because you're pumping that adrenaline because you can't hit anybody.
Yeah, that's right. So
I mean, it enhances it. It's like that alcohol you mentioned earlier, the methanol. It enhances it, makes things run faster. It's like individuals that have a loved one that had cancer, and they're so stressed out with the loss of that loved one, they end up getting it because the adrenaline, they had, say, a precancerous cells or a promoter in it, and it that adrenaline made everything happen real fast.
Wow. So it actually speeds up the whole process, something that might go very slowly in your biosystem. It actually speeds that up as well, in addition
right.
to, you know,
right.
making it so strong you can lift
also,
a car off somebody.
Yeah, I want to also share, because you and I came from industry, and we know how hazardous asbestos was. They when I was in industry, I'd have to inspect, and you'd have your safety shoes on, or you like sometimes I'd have my high heels when I'd walk around a certain area, but it would be blowing in. And they used to laugh at me, the workers there, because I'd go to the bathroom and wash my shoes off and everything and make sure that I wasn't taking it home with me as best as I could back then. And why I want to share it, because we're talking about viruses. In the 50s, there were three viruses, the polio vaccine race was for the polio. And there was the Salk, the Mahoney, and the Sabin. And the Salk was the injection one, versus the Sabin and the Mahoney were the ones that you either got in the syrup or the sugar cube. And in those particular lines, there was a contaminant, which came from the simian monkey, which was simian virus number 40. Now, that is mutated to modern times to be 45, KD45 now, which is the Dalton protein for it. But the thing is, what is very important is from the workplace, if you were exposed to that vaccine and you didn't get polio, but you had that contaminant in your system because it absorbed in the GI tract and the stomach, when you got exposed to asbestos, 100% with the simian virus and asbestos, you would get mesothelioma, which is a tumor in the stomach lining the size of a grapefruit. And I found that very interesting, that the promotion of that virus specifically to the quartz of asbestos at that certain fiber, because it used to always be one fiber if it was at the right place at the right time. But there's no one really studying that outside of myself. But I find it very interesting. If it would you be able to go back and look at those?
I mean, all of us, you know, our age have been exposed to asbestos, but we weren't exposed to the polio virus, or we were vaccinated against it when we were very young. You're saying that the combination of the polio virus and
the polio virus with the contaminant, the one that had the contaminant in the early vaccination programs that went through the United States, like between the late 50s, 61s, when it was that had the contaminant. The contaminant was the simian virus. Those vaccines, they were in the sugar cube or the little, what do you call it? It was the Sabin and the Mahoney virus lines.
I think I got
the sugar cube or the little syrup versus the shot.
The
Salk was the shot.
I didn't get the shot. I think I got the drops under the tongue.
I don't know about that one.
Maybe. I mean, it was in elementary school.
I had the little syrup thing.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Wow. So maybe I'm glad I wasn't exposed to asbestos fibers.
Yes, but
by the way, asbestos is pretty innocuous unless it's friable. Friable means that it's been busted apart and all the little fibers are now airborne and you ingest them.
Right. Needles going into the tissue.
Ouch.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me how a mineral can do that. And I don't know if anyone has ever really looked at it, or maybe yourself, as maybe it's the polar charge on it or the combination of what's in it. But I find it very interesting. It's like the new studies, which is important to not only the virus, but anything with your health. the new studies that are being done on lead and showing children who are exposed to lead that they did not have good methylation, meaning the methylation process within their liver to break down and make B vitamins within. That's what you need with methylation. It makes the B vitamins. So your body has too much lead that's really compartmentized in the liver, so you're not methylating right. And then at the same time, you lack the B vitamins and not realizing it, but your blood serum testing may show that you have high B6, because if you're lacking B6, you have extreme pain. And this is a very unique pain. It's like when you touch yourself just ever so gently, it's like pain beyond pain.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Immunochemical.
That's very interesting. Very interesting.
But you'll show high level, meaning like, say, don't hold me, audience, or Dr. Brooks, being that, say the level is supposed to be 78, and you're 100. Traditionally, you'd look at that test and say, oh, you're taking too much supplement or something in your diet or that. No, your body's responding to something that is flooding it because it's in the blood. So wherever you're lacking it with that pain, you'll experience that. And as soon as you take like vitamin B6, like 500 milligrams, mm-hmm. you don't have the pain. But how many people suffer from arthritis or any of these other types of disorders or even the symptoms of when you have too many inoculations because your body's sending out little calcium particles trying to neutralize it because of the tissue being more acidic, and then the tissue swells, but it's not swollen like an inflammation. It's
That's
like
right.
stiff, like when it locks, like your knee locks or your muscle locks. It's like hard as a board.
Yep, yep. And a lot of people notice, especially weightlifters and that do high doses of vitamin B, when they go lift, is that it will flush the skin. It actually really opens up the capillaries of the skin, and it can even make your skin tingle.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Dr. Hilde, we have a caller on line two, Neil from New York. Welcome to the program. How are you? Hold on a second. Producer's got to run across the room and get Neil on. He's out there. Neil, are you there?
Neil.
Okay. Well, he'll come on in a second. One of the things that Shoshana sent me, and this kind of goes off of this subject, but I want to keep moving along. By the way, we'll take a break in about 5 minutes, for about 5 minutes, and we'll come back for another hour. One of the subjects was about brain chips. What is a brain chip? Who makes
a brain chip? Well, what it is a biosensor. I had an individual that came to our office that was based. She's professional. There's a website on her. But what happened? She was sitting at her desk. She saw movement in the bushes, but out of the corner of her eye, and got this severe pain in her ear. What happened is the reality was that was either a nano dart or nano pellet. It went down her eustachian tube, up through the inner cavity into the brain area, into the frontal, not the frontal lobe, by the temple side. But it was very unique in that it made, she used to experience frequency in that, but it made this perfectly round ball, which is approximately 1.2 centimeters. And under MRI and CAT scan, it looked like 9 millimeters. The thing is, though, it was layered mesogen. What was odd about it when we went and had it was removed by the University of California, Los Angeles, head of neurology. They sent it to me to have it analyzed because they looked at it as a meningioma, which was a non-cancerous brain tumor. But the reality was that when we got it, it sounded like a marble. We sent it to the lab. They cut it in half, took pictures before, cut it in half. Then you could immediately see the layers of the mesogens, which are layers of scaffolding, which used to be only 8 layers thick. Now they're 20 layers thick, and you need pH frequency and release of certain chemicals. What was unique about this is that the outer layer was made out of hydropapillate, which is an enamel, very similar to our teeth, but it was artificial, meaning man-made, and the inner core was styrene, like a styrofoam cup.
Like liquid crystal with a polymer inside?
Yes. Yes. Wow. But it was hard, and to make it hard on the outside, when you have equal amounts of formulation, you have to use a microwave gun. So that meant that whatever was initially given was stimulated by a microwave source.
Wow. So this thing must have been very small when it went in her system. No way something 9 millimeters in size could go down the eustachian tube.
It would be like a nanoparticulate. Well, not nanoparticulate. It's a term called nanodarts or nano... what do you call it? I forgot right now what the other name of it is. But it will... It'd be like a weapon, you know, shot at you. And then what's the stealth side of it is that you think you got hit by a bug or something, but it stings worse than a bug, because that's what she told me. And the thing is that it's delivering a chemical. It has a purpose. It's smart.
Wow. Wow. I want to get more into detail of this. One of my listeners is... wanting to know about recommendations for new parents and trying to figure out what they should consider when it comes to their baby's first shots. What would you recommend?
I would recommend the most minimum, and also consult with your physician to find out if they're live virus or you know, live pathogen versus heat killed. And many times you can, if you can test the baby, because your natural immunity from the mother may have passed on an immunity, you could ask to just get a blood test to see if they have the titer for, I'm going to say, like measles, chickenpox, et cetera. And if they have the titer, then there's no need for vaccination.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Out here in California, they do this. We traditionally get, any of the states get your dogs vaccinated or cats vaccinated every year, but they have found that if you test the titer, they can go as long as 3 years or longer if, you know, you can show that they have a natural, they have immunity to it because they have the titer for the vaccine still in them.
Amazing. Amazing. I've already raised my 4 kids. Now I'm watching grandkids grow up. So let's take a quick 5-minute break. Just relax. Don't yell at the dog. Just relax for 5 minutes, and we'll be right back after this. Don't go away, Earth Explorers.
She broke your throne and she cut your hair and I've seen your flag on large, but love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah.
Squared Radio, second hour, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. That's Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. Wrote it. Jody, Alana, and Morgan sing it. If you want the version, it's available on iTunes. One of my favorite, most peaceful songs that we play here on X Squared Radio during the breaks. My guest tonight is Dr. Hilde. Her website, One Cell, One Light Radio. /WordPress.com. We want you to visit that. She has her own talk radio program, which is at least as interesting as X Squared Radio, and it's nice to have an authority on here to talk about the things that concern the general public. We were just talking about brain chips, and we had a caller from the last hour, and he is still hanging out there. Neil, are you there? Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am here. You are there.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm here.
Try to talk a little bit. Speakerphone? Do you have your...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
That'll take care of the echo. Okay, you have a question for us?
No, I'm just beginning to hear it. I'm having difficulty trying to contact the show on the internet, so I've only heard what I am hearing on my cell phone.
Well, you said perfect now. What brings you our way?
Enlightenment, doctor.
Well, you came to the right place. You have two of us on. We're
two candles.
Do I walk between the two or just head for one and blow out the other?
So you always have light.
Well, if you have a question for Dr. Hilde, I'd appreciate you sharing that with us.
I guess I'd ask her, how do we maintain reasonable health in this land of environmental smog and toxic pollutions without driving ourselves insane?
I think the best way and the most economical way is, try to really read the labels, watch what you're eating as, trying to stay away from modified food starch and GMO foods. Try to eat as organically as you can. Even if you grow a little bit of your own vegetables within, or tomatoes or any of that, within your own apartment, or you could do a bush or two, or you know, if you have any property. The other thing is, I've shared this with my patients, and I don't mind sharing it with you, is that we have done beautiful work with bay leaves, and bay leaves, taking just 8 bay leaves in a gallon of water and boiling them. It has so much glutathione, so much other nutrients within it that allows toxins to rid the body extremely fast when you have nothing else at that time. So it's a good and a refreshing drink, too.
Do you drink it hot or cold?
Either way. Primarily, make a gallon of it, let it cool down, and then put it in the refrigerator, like in a gallon container, and just drink it. I've ran out of milk one time. It works great as using milk and eggs when you have to batter something up. It's a very wonderful spice, but it goes back into what were the spices and what were our ancestors used to using all the time, because many times we lose that history because a lot of us are using store-bought food, prepared foods, or that, and forget our ethnic heritage or our multiple cultures that had beautiful recipes and beautiful spices within it and foods.
All right. Thank you for that. Great wisdom.
Yeah, and it works. You'll be surprised. We even manufacture a sun mist out of it. It's wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff.
Just plain bay leaves from the spice area of the store?
Right.
Okay, that I can
You'll
do.
See. You'll see, and you can tell Dr. Agnew, you know, what happened after you took it when you call into a show again.
Yeah, I'm writing it down myself. I love trying this stuff. I have to take medication for hypertension, high blood pressure, and it's been kind of, you know, up and down because I live in kind of a high-stress job. Mm-hmm. And somebody suggested doing organic apple cider vinegar. And I put it off and I delayed it and I kept taking my blood pressure medicine, living with these borderline pressures. And so one day I was at the store, called up my friend, and he said, oh, yeah, it's here on this shelf. So he guided me to it by phone. I bought it. I went home. And Saturday morning I was going to go work out, so I did a little bit of the apple cider vinegar. I went and worked out, stopped off at the CVS and checked my blood pressure, and it was about 35 points down from where it was. I was amazed at how much it lowered my blood pressure. Do you have any idea what's going on there?
Right. Well, one is in the stomach lining, you're absorbing your potassium from the apple cider vinegar because it's high in potassium. And that lowers down blood pressure. But also, that apple cider vinegar, because of the potassium with it, acts as a catalyst so that it can react and absorb through the stomach, go through the liver, and then clean up the methylation process. Old remedy used to be drink a lot of green tea to lower it, but apple cider vinegar is wonderful now.
Wow, that's amazing. I love the homeopathic things, but I never expected to see such a dramatic change. You know, maybe 5 points or 10 points, but 35, it was just phenomenal. And I even noticed that I felt different while I worked out, you know, because especially when I was doing my like upside down sit-ups, the pressure in my head was a lot less. I was amazed. And now, is that something that I have to do every day for the rest of my life? I do it a couple times a week and keep that potassium level high?
A lot of people that have digestive problems, which basically is based on that they, one, have a history or have ancestors that drank a lot where they have small villi that clump up, like if you in your intestinal colon, so you can't make enough bacteria, and you have digestive problems. But to answer your question in reference to the apple cider vinegar, when you need something, you'll just take it. And what I have found is that when it's absorbed properly, the apple cider vinegar, when you don't need it, it's when it doesn't taste sour to you anymore. But when it tastes real sour, you need it. So I don't look at anything taking it forever, just as long as you need it and it's working properly with you.
That is just great, great advice. I know the listeners out there are listening to that stuff too. By the way, my IMer is writing back, and she's asking about the immunity again for the baby, and she's saying, does the child inherit any immunities from the father or just the mother?
No, both. And this is important because a lot of individuals think that it only comes primarily from the mother because of the egg. But chemicals, even toxins, can come from the father, just as the immunity, whatever he may have been vaccinated for.
How about that? So it really
and this goes back into the genetic manipulation as we go farther in your show today about that.
Yeah, that's my next subject, as a matter of fact. From time to time, we talk about bioengineering of food, for instance. Of course, Monsanto is the main culprit that is earning and spending hundreds of millions of dollars bribing bureaucrats and politicians around the world to allow their seeds to be planted in soils and consumed by humans and animals that are consumed by humans as well. So who's checking up on this? Who's protecting the human race against this gigantic economic juggernaut of Monsanto and changing our foods, blending corn with jellyfish and wheat with who knows what?
Well, it should be our FDA and our Department of Agriculture, just by looking at who would be responsible under regulations, wouldn't you think?
Well, I would think that, but it is, you know, lots of papers that we have covered on this program show that some of the very officials that are working in the FDA, not only in this country, but also in the World Health Organization, are actually bought and paid for, or at least financed by Monsanto. In fact, some of them are former Monsanto employees.
Right. They retired from one position, go into another position, and also maybe chaired in universities or anything where there's a stipend along the way.
Well, one of the things the World Health Organization has done is they're pushing for a surveillance system and monitoring of overweight people. And they're trying to get governments to implement behavior modification programs and even, I guess, dietary modification programs to keep people from getting overweight. Of course, the target of these researchers is North America, because even though we make up 6% of the global population, more than a third of us are obese. So, you know, I guess they're calling it globesity. And between genetically modified foods and pharmaceuticals, you know, we're the target. So we're the market for that stuff. And I can't tell you how many of my friends would walk down to the pharmacy in the middle of the night, if that's what it took, to get a drug that would peel 50 pounds off of them without them having to change their lifestyles.
Right, but shouldn't they also ask themselves, what is causing this obesity? In particular, this obesity has really occurred in the last 10 years, especially after that book Fatland came out. But the thing is, you've got to ask yourself, too, meaning from myself as a toxicologist, what is causing what's causing the body to store fat or to make fat? Number one, usually it is a toxin that is coming through the body that stimulates the liver to encapsulate it, because for whatever reason, the majority of humans they store everything because they never know when they're not going to have food in their body. And we must have starved a long time because that memory's there in that genetic code. And it stores. Because a lot of this malformed, the question is then, is it regular fat or malformed fat? Because a lot of the energy houses, which are in the, which is what they call brown fat, is high in mitochondria. So for the body not to have energy, something's cutting off the mitochondria or not allowing the cell, excuse me, the organelle, the mitochondria within the cell to absorb 15 photons that go in to make one ATP molecule so that you can have the energy to run or do anything. And a lot of things that I found was not only the genetically modification, because a majority of this genetically modification of whatever they're modifying, whoever the manufacturer is, it has a chemical with it. These chemicals are usually insecticides, chemicals that causes our body to go acidic, causes our body to be stimulate to coat that chemical and stimulate with triglycerides or cholesterol to come out and make malformed fat, which then stores, and then you have these obese people. But I have not seen anyone look at even a fat sample of these individuals or even test their body or their blood to see, or their history if they're eating a lot of these modified foods that have the chemicals in it, because they're getting a small dose of chemical with that modification. And also, in some of the splicing of these genetically modified foods or in some of the prepared foods, they add what they term modified food starch. Half of it is the starch, like corn, potato, whatever the starch may be, the source. But the other half, it's a one-to-one ratio, is waterborne polyurethane. Waterborne polyurethane is styrene.
Yeah, we use it in paint.
Right, and you can't break it down. So is that why our body is storing it and making this malformed fat, and then these people are overweight? Are they just, as I call it, there is one to regain fat and not metabolization. To me, when I see a person that is overweight or gained 20 pounds, whatever it may be, I look at the density of the muscle and also are you swollen? Because if you can touch the person and it doesn't pop back out the skin, it's puffy, there more edema is occurring. And so what is causing that? The majority you'll find out is a history of chemical exposure, meaning spraying in the house, et cetera, this way, or the use of these genetically modified foods. Because also, they changed the labels recently, because I did a criteria document for EA in reference to modified food starch. And the thing is that within the last 3 months or so, they're changing the labels that you do not have to label the processed food that it has modified food starch in it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. There was recently a proposition in California, of all places, where they would require adding to this little, you know, food information label that goes on all foods now, everything from, you know, nuts to everything, saying that there were genetically modified foods used to make it, whether it's chips or beans or whatever it is. But it was voted down in California. Of all places, they voted it down.
Right. And usually California, like even the Proposition 65, or at least it notified what was the reproductive hazards or anything. It's always been a progressive state in recognizing the concern, but it didn't get passed. And it's even, you know, with modified food and the obesity, it's not just one thing. They're getting bombarded. Maybe these individuals also had a series of vaccines. And we talked earlier on your program about that, but there was a beautiful article written by two Harvard professors, which was William Lucas and David Knapp. And it was an article on viral capsids and envelopes and structure and function. And you mentioned earlier about the virus the vaccines having protein. I'm just going to read a little, two sentences for
sure.
The audience and yourself. Virus particles contain the viral genome packaged in a protein coat called a capsid and sometimes a lipid coat called the envelope. These structures play many roles in viral infection, including virus entry into cells and spread from one cell to another. So you could have design protein coats that have other viruses. We've always studied, with the GMO food or any of that, where it's got the chemical in it, like what they did in the cotton industry, which was in India. It wiped out the whole cotton production because they had to use genetically modified seeds, rather. And at the same time, that goes into alternative, alternative commodities or alternative, I can't think of the right term, but it's a tradable stock entry over Wall Street. And many people made money on that.
Right. It is a commodity. One of the main, well, there's two main features that they try to go for in the GMOs. One is that they're Roundup ready. You hear that term all the time in the farm industry. What this means is that farmers need an herbicide. Otherwise, the weeds take over the nutrients of the soil, choke out the plant, and they also get into the harvest because the weeds are much more prolific. And so they like to spray their crops with Roundup because it's just one of the chemicals that works really well at killing everything. Except they want the plant. They want the wheat or the oats or the barley or whatever they're growing to grow. And so they modify the seed of the GMO, the genetically modified organism, so that it's immune or not doesn't respond to the Roundup. Now, the fact that it's Roundup ready, this chemical tag or marker that's put onto it gets in several parts of the plant. Now, you'd think, if you think about this, the flower, right, the thing that's germinated, when it is germinated by bees or wind or just close proximity of the plants one to another, they give off seed. The seed is what we eat, right? That's the food. That's
right,
the fruit
the
of vine.
The seed or the fruit, yes.
But the flowers, in being, you know, pollinated by bees or honeybee or hummingbirds or whatever, has the marker in the pollen. And so the pollen carried back to the hive was actually killing off the bees or making them sterile. And that's what they had to go back in and change in order to make their seeds acceptable. Unfortunately for the third world countries, they use them as the human clinic to test the food.
Right, and that to me, that's wrong for any fellow human. It's like the little clip you did on the ants. You need to be strong together. The other thing is, too, with that compound, the Roundup, the primary chemical that was in it was Fluorvacil. Fluorvacil in the late 50s was tested in Hungary, and they found that if an animal had removed, I'll give you an example, say a cow had its uterus removed, what would happen is if there was any cells left, it would regenerate a new uterus. And it was very interesting of what happened. And maybe that is why if you're eating these, I'm going to say genetically modified corn, and we haven't even addressed that a number one vitamin, which we all recommend or use, is vitamin C. We listen to all of the works of Linus Pauling, twice Nobel laureate. Turn around, they take it out of genetically modified corn and make the vitamin C now.
Oh, my goodness. So, it's
so you don't even know if you're getting true vitamin C.
My goodness. And they probably don't have to put it on the bottle either. So what do you recommend? Is it Citracal? Is it, what is the brand of vitamin C that you recommend over the counter that we should take?
I recommend when you look at the label or you can call their manufacturer, do not do time release because it's usually got the nanopolymers or the particulates in it. And then the other is whatever brand is out there that has a high amount of vitamin C. And you'll be surprised that even like Bobo, there's a fruit that has high vitamin C that's, you know, with a lot. So you don't have to look traditionally at the citrus, you know, we think. Limes, any of that you can get it from. Even acai had high amounts of vitamin C. And you know you're lacking vitamin C. All these dentists say, oh, you've got gingivitis because your lip, your gums are bleeding. Gums bleed for two reasons. One, lack of vitamin C, and number two, arsenic. So if you were exposed to arsenic, and we've seen it in the waters, we've seen it in the workplace, we've seen it in a lot of mineral components that you might use that they don't label it. But the thing is that if you've got that and you lack vitamin C, your gums will bleed. But as soon as you take, you know, like 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, your gums don't bleed. So what happened to the gingivitis?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's and dentists see diseases sometimes before anybody else does because of the sensitivity of, I guess, epithelial cells that make up the lining of the mouth. They divide and die so fast that they will express disease in the body first. So it's a good place to look if you're having a disease in your body is the inside of the mouth.
Right.
Let's get into the area of pharmaceuticals because it just seems like we're eating genetically modified corn, which is giving us this abnormal fat, which is almost impossible to lose.
Right.
It doesn't.
And also, I forgot to add, you know, in reference to when I was talking about the uterus regenerating with the cow in those Hungary studies in 1957, the thing is, though, we have a number one with females that have their uterus, they're getting fibroids. And this can be from that same chemical or any of these modified foods because there's an increase of fibroids.
I notice a lot of women telling me and telling friends of mine that they're having abnormal cycles, sometimes two a month. Sometimes they go 2 months without having one, and then they'll have two. And I notice that when groups of women get together, their cycles tend to synchronize. But that's
correct.
Not happening anymore. The cycles are scattering all over the place. Do you think it's diet related?
I think it's diet related, and also I know you said that you didn't know much about the chemtrails, but definitely the spraying, being whether they're spraying for mosquitoes that you don't see, and using their new vaccines that are in the mosquitoes for malaria, and in some states. There hasn't been any malaria, but that's a whole new delivery system of vaccines. Let the mosquito bite you and then get sprayed and trying to kill the mosquitoes. So you do inhale more than what you even did 5 years ago or anything. No matter what any individual says that's being sprayed in the skies, whether which are definitely chemtrails or any of that, but the thing is, it's a particle. It's coming down. You're breathing it. You're inhaling it. I experienced here in California that it was supposed to rain. It did not rain. It was like this jelly coming out of the, you know, like a gelatinous mask hitting you and burning you when it hit. So what was that? Was that hydrogel? I don't know. But the thing is that a lot of people ended up getting sick within 2 weeks after that experience. So anything, I mean, is it healthy to breathe dust? No.
Right, because the dust has, you know, everything that's blowing along the streets and dirt roads of your country. I know we live here in the South, and they often do announce that they're going to go out and spray for mosquitoes. Don't worry about it. You know, it's a, or in, I think we covered last week an article where they were releasing genetically modified mosquitoes
yes.
into the population of mosquitoes of Florida. These
right,
are all
Florida and the, now I think they released it in other cities, but what we found very interesting out here in California is I was telling a colleague of mine about this, you know, that was happening in Florida. And what I found very interesting is that our United States Air Force was doing the spraying of it, which was not the pesticide section or the mosquito control section, you know, of a state. But why any military would have to do that is if there was a radioactive nucleotide or anything with it.
That does
seem
strange.
Interesting. But why I'm going is that I said this to my friend, and the friend believed me, and at the same time, he went to the dentist and was telling his dentist about it, and she heard that night, because there was no announcement of being sprayed here in California in the Los Angeles area. That night, she heard on the evening news that they were going to spray the second time in Los Angeles. So when did the first happen, with the jelly rain?
Yeah. What in the world is doing to us?
Well, the world is this. Under current laws or anything that we have experienced as the event of what happened in New York 10 years ago with the fall of the Twin Towers, et cetera, and that was a devastating event. But certain laws allowed different agencies to be exempt, being academia, pharmaceutical, agriculture, military, industry, and Department of Energy, that they could develop technology that would countermeasure any of those types of terrorists or any of that type of activity, and you do not have to inform the people that's being tested. So I think with a lot of these events of what has happened over the last 10 years and the development of technologies, and all of us went to universities, all of us went had to get a degree in engineering or sciences or talks or any of this thing. But it used to be that the university that you graduated from or the college you graduated from was run by a board of directors. They were usually local people or people from that state where the school was created. But now it is not only the board of trustees, but the board of trustees now have what they call a foundation, the university's foundation, and that university foundation is what partners with industry, military, et cetera, and they get funded for different projects. And usually when you see the trustees that are on these university foundations, they usually come from the bankrupt companies of the major trading companies or companies that recently went out of business or bankrupt, and they've been in business over 100 years.
Yeah,
I
see
this very
a lot.
Interesting, Dr. Agnew.
Yeah, because universities, besides being places of higher learning, are also places of business. And in order to accept money from granting organizations, they themselves have to have a nonprofit instrument or organization in their university. So these foundations, as Dr. Hilde is discussing, receives grant money from various agencies and sometimes commercial industries to do research in certain areas. I did some of my postgraduate work in the nuclear industry, and some of it was financed by the oil and gas industry. So that's a good example of that. I benefited from that. Some of my education was paid for, and I earned money while I was doing that and developed some great technology. But some of this funding comes from what we consider the headwaters, I guess, of all this kind of grant money, and that would be the military. Lots of times, these different programs, sometimes it's in communication and software and bioterrorism protection, but sometimes it's in biology and virology and other things like that. The money comes from the weapons industry, and so that money is being used to develop weapons. And sometimes the students don't even know about it. They're just doing a piece here and a piece there. They don't really know what they're culturing or what they're mixing up.
Correct.
And like you said, normally at the Board of Regents, it's all, you know, local people, former alums from that that university. But these foundations are often made up of financial experts and lawyers and former military people.
Right. And why is that? Why that is necessary in that whole strategic group is that because whatever is created needs to have the potential to make money from the research side goes into the commercialization. So it's research and commercialization development, and then whoever funds it or who would like to license it, then it becomes licensable, and it can go into international licensing or local licensing of whatever it may be involved with at that level, too. It's a new form of money.
It is. It is.
And also very important is prior, because the new patent laws change in March. I think it's the 13th, but my attorney told me to by the 1st. But the thing is that in the past, if you were patenting something, a prime example was Marconi and Tesla. Tesla did all the original work, et cetera. Marconi put in the patent for the radio, and then it was turned within, I think, like 5 years ago or that, the whole patent ruling was turned that awarded the patent back to Tesla and his estate, okay, for the radio. But the thing is, what was the proof of that was that Tesla was working on it years or before Marconi. Okay, Marconi did his thing and put it in, okay, where Tesla didn't. But in the new patent rules that start in March of 2013, it's where whoever puts the patent in first is going to be awarded it, even if they hung out by your next-door neighbor who put 20 years in inventing some technology and just didn't have the funds to do the technology, the next-door neighbor can put it in and say it's all his work. You don't have that proof. It's the date of the patent application.
That's correct. That's correct. And I
remember, and that's going to affect a lot of individuals that are, I'm going to say, individuals like ourselves or that yes, we are in companies or that, but we're companies that we founded ourselves in the early growth or anything. But it's where the small business or the individual, it's getting harder for them to patent.
Well, it is. I mean, I patent stuff, you know, on a regular basis. And just because you file the provisional and then you refine it, and less than a year later you have to file the utility patent, it's a few $100s. But then you have to wait between 2 and 5 years before the examiner ever even looks at it. So, and if you've made any mistakes in it or you want to make modifications to it, that's more money. You know, I can read stories of when Edison and others literally used a foot race to the patent office to file stuff so that they could be the first. That's our system of protection. Then if you want to file a PCT, which gives you international protection, in the United States, each patent will cost the inventor $10,000 just in government fees, the government fees to get the patent filed. So the age of having 100 patents under your name is over if you're going to have international protection.
Yes, and it's over in you're very fortunate when if you do it yourself or work with your attorney on it. But it used to be the individual could do it themselves and that, but the laws are changing so rapidly and so much anymore. It's like you even have to be a registered patent agent to even get it submitted into the system now.
Well, you don't actually, but it is a lot easier because if you make a mistake and leave a document out in your initial submission, what's going to happen is it's going to get kicked back to you and it's going to cost more money. If you submit all the documents in the correct format, you can file it yourself, but it does take some practice. I would recommend becoming, you know, an agent yourself if you're going to file a lot of patents. I do file quite a few, and I'm still not a registered filer. So it can be done.
Well, that's good. Then you're saving yourself a lot of money if you can take that. That's a new trade, too, for some individuals to learn.
Well, maybe I'll change jobs and give up the talk radio host job. But you know, and I never have made any money with the patents, but it does give me, you know, a position to be able to run my company, and that's good. Let's talk a little bit about transhumanism, because we're talking about genetically modified foods. Now we're doing genetically modified people. Researchers are pursuing custom lab-grown replacement of organs. Believe me, they've done it hundreds of times, and they're getting better at it every day. They can now do kidneys. They can do heart valves, ears, all kinds of things, rather than relying on organ donors. Experts in the field of regenerative medicine are getting ready to launch this as an industry. Recently, Swedish scientists successfully created a custom vein for a little girl that carries blood from her intestines to her liver. Another patient was implanted with a new trachea grown in a lab, all with their own cells. No risk of rejection. This is being done in a lab factory. And they're able to literally inkjet print the base culture with the structure using an inkjet printer loaded with the person's cells. Now, obviously, this is specialized equipment and not what you buy down at Best Buy, but it's coming along, and it's not going to be very long, according to the folks down at Wake Forest University Laboratory, that they're going to be able to really custom order you an organ prior to you going into surgery, and you're going to get a new heart that you grew out of your own cells in a lab. So what's going on with the transhumanism movement?
It's a growing business, not only in the organ. Hello? Organs,
yeah,
organism, but also in the food business. In other words, you could culture your own steak and shape it in a mold, just as they do for these organs. They do put it in a mold, meaning whether it's a clear, high-density polyethylene or that, but to retain the shape. And a lot of that is using stem cells.
So they're actually growing beef muscle in a lab, just like you would steak, instead of growing a cow?
Right. And I have seen papers where it's like commercially available, but you don't know if you've got regular cow or, you know, clone cow.
Well, that's extremely interesting. The other method of transhumanism is where, of course, we're seeing cyber humans. We're seeing all kinds of prosthetic devices being put on the outside of the human, but also prosthetic devices being put on the inside of the human, not just pacemakers, but other things more advanced than that. What are you seeing in that region of, say, changing a human into a para-human?
I know the military has done that. They did that with a joint collaborative work with MIT, you know, for the super soldier, looking at new equipment and also regenerative tissue, muscles, skin, all of that.
Well, a lot of this is not being done with human stem cells. Some of it's being done with what we call animal-human hybrids. Now, admittedly, this is being done in the lab. For instance, they'll take human cells and put it in a mouse or human cells and put it in a primate in order to study, say, Alzheimer's or study insulin production. But what's to stop them from doing it the other way, taking the animal traits and putting it into a human to create this super soldier you're talking about?
Right, with strength or endurance. And you've got the right scientists and the right funding, they could do it if they haven't done it already.
Well,
I say that, Dr. Egg, is because the thing is, we do know in these pluripotent cells from the stem that, say that's a mouse cell and you put it into the human cell, but you take out the memory of that cell and it's supposed to go out. But if all conditions are right for it, it will come back. The memory within that cell can come back, even with stem cells, meaning you might have it for your trachea, but you do not want to have it cultured from an ear and have an ear grow out of your throat. There are things that can happen.
I was interviewing Dr. Bruce Lipton. He wrote a great book mm-hmm. called The Biology of Belief.
Yes.
You might have spoken to him as well.
I spoke to him. I met him one time a long time ago.
Well, the interesting thing that he was doing research, because he was a medical school instructor down in the Caribbean, they were removing the nucleus from a cell to study what the effect would be on that cell. And those days it was believed that the nucleus was the brain of the cell, and that if you removed it, the cell would forget how to defend itself and how to respirate, and that it would shortly die. But that's not what happened at all. The cells kept on protecting themselves against toxins, and they consumed fuel and respirated just like a normal cell, and they grew old and died. Of course, they couldn't replicate because they didn't have any genetic material with which to do so. But the thing that amazed them and interested them and drove them to find an answer was, how did the cell know how to do what it was supposed to do during its normal lifespan? And what they've discovered is that the program is written, or at least stored, into the cell's membrane. It acts like a liquid crystal. It acts like the same gates and channels that we see in an ordinary integrated circuit. And so Dr. Hilde's exactly right. This memory isn't necessarily stored only in the genetic material that's in the nucleus. It's also stored in the proteins that make up the cell wall. So you're using stem cells, yeah, they'll differentiate into a trachea, but you know, you might grow an index finger out of the middle of your neck someday.
Right, and individuals that, I'm going to say, have the choice of growing their own heart versus getting a donor heart, that might be the right choice for them to grow their own heart so that they don't have to be on the antibiotics or the rejection of that, but that's their choice. But at the same time, it's where they should have informed consent and knowing that things can happen. Everyone wants everything peachy keen and everything nice, but they need to know the risk of what's going to happen if it's not their cultured own cells or any of this, because it's the risk is there. It's like the ants. All you need is one. Then it all crumbles.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about the motivation behind it then. If we're talking about a possibility of uninformed consent or uninformed exposure of people to these kinds of changes, and we tie this into the amazing amount of funding that's going on for weaponry, I think you'll agree that, yeah, we have a violent and possibly nasty neighborhood in which we live, but we really have not been at war in the sense like we fought in World War I, World War II, Korean, Vietnam, etc. We haven't been at war like that, one soldier or one uniformed soldier against another, for a long, long time. But we're spending 1,000 times more on national defense than we ever have. What's the purpose of that? Who are we fighting? What's the reason for all this money?
Well, I think with anything, every country wants their own defense system of protecting their country or their power at be within, I'm going to say, the whole global arena. But the whole thing is, we know that nanomaterials, nanotechnology, biosensories, the tags that you mentioned with the GMO, any of this, it can be used and payable under Medicare. At the same time, that same technology, there's a beautiful paper written by the War College called Pandora's Box. You can take the same pathogens and gear it into a dust and just sprinkle it, and then people get leprosy or any of these pathogens. It can happen. But you don't have to use airplanes. You don't have to use any of that. You could use drones.
Well, yeah, and if you combine that with radio frequencies that might be broadcasted in that same area, now you have control over the pathogen as well.
Right.
I guess the question I have is, you know, who has this kind of weaponry under the control? And when did we, the people that go to the mall and go to church and peacefully live our lives, when did we become the enemy? When did our lifestyle become a threat to the world leaders?
I don't know when, and outside of the events that have occurred, you know, in the last 10 years or so, when that waking up occurred. But at the same time, it's where it's really like a race of the new technology. Who is in control over it? We've seen many battles even with who controls certain stem cell banks or any of that. So it's a race of a country for that technology to be the power leader of that. And then if the country's in the leadership, then it's the industry that would use it in the delivery system.
Well, we were talking about super soldiers earlier, and my military friends often say, well, the reason that we develop this technology is because we know that our enemies are doing it, and if we don't do it, we're going to be faced with having to defend against it. And one thing I know after living my life, and I've served in the military, and I have lots of friends in the military, humans really are not meant to fight one another. The human being is not natural to warfare. When we fight one another, it permanently damages something in the human soul. And the proof is, and I claim, that suicide has always been the number one cause of death in and after any battle. And the loss of fear to stand in front of the path of the bullet is really the path of suicide. When you first get out there in the battlefield, you're so scared to death that you survive. But after you go through the first few battles and you end up killing someone else or many people, you lose that fear to stand in front of the bullet. And it's often said that somebody that serves four tours, somebody wants them dead, because sooner or later it's going to happen. Coming home after three or four, eight tours and getting a job at the cell phone store at the mall is a path to suicide. You can see it in their eyes. And right now, suicide is the number one cause of death among U.S. veterans. And I can tell you right now that the United States spends 10 times more than anyone else for Wars R Us. That's what I call them. And I guess my question for you is, you know, do you think that these super soldiers are going to be repaired in some way, genetically repaired, so that they lose their fear in the battlefield? In fact, most of my military friends, the officers at least, don't call them soldiers anymore. They're not called airmen. They're not called Marines. They're called war fighters. That's what they call them.
Interesting. But definitely, because there was, DARPA did a big study in reference to pheromones, measuring the amount of fear and studying all that. And what I found very interesting during the time of that so-called study is when they were spraying all the brown moth and people were experiencing overwhelming fear.
So they were staying in their homes and not saying anything cross.
Right, you know, like afraid to go out or any of that. Total out of character.
And what were they spraying? Brown moss?
Well, at that time, it was brown moth using pheromones.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay, so yeah. This
and
was...
And then at the same time, after that, is when I found individuals that when they had a black light, I used a black light on them, that went into that area or where they went into the spraying of that area, they would have a yellow dye in their eyes, the sclera, which we call the Eye of Horus effect, which goes back into the Rhind Egyptian mathematics project, where if the dye was in the sclera of the eye, the white of the eye that is by the bridge of the nose, then it would be the smell, the olfactory senses, versus on the other side of the eye, closer to the temple, it would be the hearing. So I looked at it as some type of delivery system that was be able to be seen with night vision goggles that show also, you know, UVB.
Hmm. Interesting.
But it goes back into your slot for, you know, soldiers now.
Hmm. Well, I mean, one of the interesting things that I hear is that there are two things that they want for their warfighters. One is they want them to lose their fear in the battlefield. They don't want them to put their heads down. They want them to rush headlong against the enemy and scare them even worse. And the second is if they get injured, they want to get them back on their feet and back in the battlefield as quickly as possible. Those are the two things that they want for their warfighters.
Right, and that's why they developed a lot of the nanotechnology, especially out of the Soldier Institute, you know, for new muscle, new so that you could sprinkle a powder. And I'm using this as an example. Say you got shot or you've got a broken leg, you can sprinkle the powder and it would go into place. That's my simple version, but they were looking at different technologies that way.
Well, one of my IMers says that soldiers come back with nightmares because they feel guilt of killing another human deeply. And I wrote back and said, well, that's good. But what if they didn't feel the guilt? I think that would be the worst thing. Yeah, they, you know, the nightmares are bad, but not having the nightmares, having gone out and done that, and you know, warfighters going all the way back to, you know, Roman times, all had the same problem. There's no glory in war at all. Even the generals will tell you that. But they have a mission to do. And, you know, right now we're not really fighting an army. We're fighting ghosts. We're fighting money. We're fighting just to be fighting, just to be spending money. And I think we're in a different age. And it may be that, you know, there are those that stand to gain so much from keeping the world at war that they won't let it go to peace.
Right. Well, many, I'm going to say, profiteers in any type of battle, whether it was Civil War, whether the Revolutionary War, or anyone, the ones that made the money, you know, usually were funding both sides of the fence and at the same time creating technologies from that. Look at just what in the Civil War of just selling liquor because there was no anesthetic to both sides of the North and the South to use as anesthetic. In other words, knock out the person with the alcohol,
mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm.
whiskey. But with any of that, there's profiteers. And, you know, Eisenhower said a long time ago, watch out for the industrial military complex when they become one.
One of my listeners writes me and says that there's a new brain-computer interface to facilitate communication between the mind and external machines. And this technology actually began in the 1970s. But now it's through DARPA has resulted in neuroprosthetic applications that reconnect the natural sensors in the human brain to electronic effector channels and make the prosthetics more functional. I think that's really cool. But, you know, DARPA has a $2 million, $2 billion a year budget for research into creating super soldiers using this synthetic, you know, extra energy or extra coordination or extra strength that's delivered by these BCIs.
But it's not necessarily extra strength or extra energy. It has to have some type of mesogen, some type of lock-in. That lock-in can be a chemical, it can be a scaffold, you know, however it's arranged. It's like the lady that got hit in the ear and experienced the brain chip. Was that the preliminary brain interface for a computer or anything? The thing is, thank God she had the money and the insurance to get it out. But there are individuals that want it, you know, the interface of the computer. But once that happens, Once that happens, you may gain your intelligence and everything, but you lost your own individual sovereignty.
Yeah, that's what my friend...
And you've served in the military. I come from a family of 1,000 years of military. And I'm the first one to say, no, not it's enough. But the thing is that when you're in the military, you sign a contract. You are owned by the government by which you are serving to protect that nation.
That's true.
And as under that contract, they may do whatever they want with you, possibly.
That's true. You I served in the tropical paradise of Grand Forks, North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wintertime, it gets quite cold there. And they give you the proper gear to avoid frostbite. But if you are treated for frostbite, you will receive an Article 15 because you were told how to keep yourself from getting frostbite, and your body belongs to the U.S. military. So if you damage it, you're going to be written up.
Right. It's you know, when you look at it in that perspective of just a simple contract, and you may get benefits from it, you may... it's like all of the ones who served in World War One, World War Two rather. Majority of the individuals, no matter what the military was, they became alcoholics because of whatever they had to deal with during that time. In these
sure.
generations that you shared about military personnel that served to protect all of us and doing a wonderful job, turn around, they're dying of suicide. Each generation had their own escape route, which was not really an escape because, as you said, Dr. Agnew, they're a human being killing another human. When they take that soul, it shatters their soul.
You're right. And I'm saying that as even though we, you know, appear to be a violent society, when has there been a time when we have not been at war since, I don't know what, the mid-1800s, the late 1700s, somewhere in this world? But it isn't the soldiers that want that war. It's the soldiers that are ordered to go to war. It's the soldiers that are trained. And it was so interesting. I met a poet when I was down in Mississippi, and he wrote a poem about the young soldiers that would come to Hattiesburg, Mississippi before shipping out to... during World War II, and they would go out in the forests and the jungles out in Mississippi and practice killing. And then they would come to town and go to the movies and eat out because they weren't really actually killing anybody. So they were all fine. I mean, they were stabbing, you know, straw statues of people, but they hadn't actually killed anybody. And so everybody was just as happy as they could be having their uniform on. But when they came back, it was a completely different person. We're not designed naturally to kill one another. War is not natural to us. So is it this military-industrial complex? Is it this economic industrialists who are insulated by walnut cabinetry and glass skyscrapers from the real battlefield that's making the war happen?
It's a possibility.
Well,
probably right a bullseye.
Exactly. We ran just a little bit over, but that's okay because it's my program. Let's take a 5-minute break, and if you will stay with me another half hour, can you do that?
Of course.
Oh, wonderful. All right, we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you right after Civil Twilight.
Fall into the sea, and they'll know. We were made to never fall away. Never fall away.
Back to X Squared Radio, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. By the way, those of you listening on the conference line, we understand there's a little bit of a bad sound. We'll try to get that fixed at the studio. We're working on it. My guest tonight is Dr. Hilde. Her website, onecellonelight.radio/wordpress.com. Check it out, because this is only a small sample of what you're going to hear on that program. Lots and lots of great expertise. Dr. Hilde, I visited China a few times, and one of the things I noticed when I was over there is that there are these mega cities that are under construction everywhere. I mean, you rent a hotel, you're up 25 floors, and you look out at night, and you just see welding arcs everywhere. And I've seen huge cities over there with roads and hotels and factories and massive amounts of apartments, but they're all vacant. And the countryside is abandoned. And I ask myself, you know, I've heard rumors that there are all these Chinese. Where are they all? Are they moving the farmers into the cities? That's my question. And if they are, is there a risk in doing that? I mean, are we meant to be spread out and in smaller communities? Are we meant to live 30, 40, 50 million people to a city and then leave the countryside, you know, vacant for farming?
I've never been to China, but I do know that about 25 years ago, the American Industrial Hygiene and a lot of other organizations were asked to look at their safety program, et cetera, because of, like you said, welding, et cetera. They wouldn't use welding goggles, safety glasses, or any of this stuff. I honestly don't know if that's still occurring that way over there, but I do know that a lot in the, especially like in the Mongolian area, that a lot of people that had farms or living out in that area would go into the cities for, I'm going to say, better opportunity or education that way. Maybe that's occurring too, but at the same time, at what cost? Because I've been told over there, there is a lot of people that are working and doing labor, but maybe it's not at the same rate of finances as what we have over here or anything for that same labor.
Well, that's true. It's it is a much less labor rate, and some of the jobs, I'm going to call them, the tasks that are being done that we would normally do with one person or two people along with some ergonomic assist are being done with six or seven people because why, I don't know. I guess because labor is that cheap. But you're right. Safety gloves, glasses, hearing protection, things like that are not well distributed. And the other thing that I notice is the glass on the outside of the buildings is etched as though it's been affected with acid rain.
It may. I know that I got a sample one time from a colleague of mine that we were looking at doing a project in reference to cleaning up the rivers over there. That sample of that one sample of water had so much chemical, so much pollution in it. I don't know what in the world they'd ever use to clean up that water that's within many of these communities. So it's going to leach, you know, with their terrain and everything into their aquifers or anything like that.
Well, I totally agree. You know, we when we build a factory, we have three different segments of water. One is the potable water, of course, the stuff in your pipes and the stuff that goes down the sewer. The other is your industrial waste. These are things that you don't want to get into the drain water or go down the drain until it's treated. A lot of this stuff has to be filtered through sand and through carbon and sometimes through reverse osmosis filters before the effluent or the water that's coming out of the plant is clean enough to go down the drain. And the third is the rainwater. All of the gutters of the building, the parking lot of the building, anywhere where rain can land and run off into the creeks or into the soil. And we are highly regulated, highly monitored. Sometimes it's the Department of Labor. Sometimes it's the Department of Environmental Quality. But somebody is measuring and watching that, and there are standards to which we have to adhere. When we, and I come from the automotive industry, we install a new paint plant, for instance. All the overspray from those cars is collected in filters and in water and collected outside the plant in a big pit we call a sludge pit. And then that sludge is collected and incinerated because we don't want to get it into the environment until it's completely broken down into its basic levels of CO2 and even smaller. But over there, they just let the paint sludge run over the hillside. I saw it with my own eyes.
Yeah.
Where does that go? What does that become? How does that affect people?
And it's not just that one area. It's all those buildings going up, everything. It's very toxic. I know several of my friends have gone over there. They've loved it, et cetera. But I often wonder, my God, why are you sick now after you went over on a trip, you know, like a year or two later? Could be from your exposure.
I know when I came back, and I'm not the only one. I had another friend who went to China and also Tibet. And when they came back, and I did too, I had a cough literally for 3 months. It was a dry cough, and it really bothered me because I couldn't even complete a sentence. Just the vibration of my voice against my lungs irritated them to the point where I would cough in the middle of a sentence. I couldn't finish, you know, 5 words without a cough. And it was really frightening to me. I went to the doctor about it. He couldn't find anything. Maybe it was a toxic reaction to
right,
the air quality.
You mentioned that the windows were etched, appeared etched, like it was exposed to acid rain. And it could be just in the air that you were breathing, just changing it that way, even if it had acid water that way, you know, in the humidity.
Well, it could be. It could be. And I couldn't imagine living a lifetime or having children, raising children in that environment. I just, when we compare it against how strict we are, even in the rural areas, even farms are very, very conscious about what gets dumped out on the fence row.
Right. We have, excuse me for interrupting you, but look at that consciousness of that health and safety in the environment, because the laws that you stated, you know, the OSHA or even the EPA or anything, that was passed in 1970. That's only 42 years of being conscious in that realm versus other areas haven't even got to that level.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, in Tibet, they're strip mining with the old high-pressure water that they just, you know, get river water, and they put it in high-pressure pumps, and they literally strip the minerals, you know, off the hillside and then sluice what they need, the iron, the copper, nickel, you know, stuff like that. And they're using chemicals to extract gold and things like that out of the mud. All that stuff just goes right down in the river, which just keeps flowing.
Right, and it ends up becoming a dead area. Because look at what happened when they were doing all the mining for coal and everything up in the Pennsylvania area before the regulations came in. Those soils were dead after those strip mining and that until it came back.
One of my listeners writes me, nobody has to declare war on China. They have declared war on themselves.
Meaning by because of the environment in that?
Yeah, they've declared environmental war on themselves. And it's like any, you know, biological or zoological population that, you know, we've studied in our lifetimes. Once the population gets so dense in one area, handling the waste and the food and the management of offspring becomes untenable, even for the simplest populations.
Yes, that always happens with any civilization and the ages of those different civilizations.
Yes, it does. Well, you know, our civilization is not that old, but I think we have, at least as a nation, somewhat become enlightened. We've become made aware. This Right to Know program and your great book, Hazardous Chemical Handbook, has let us know what we're exposing ourselves to, what we're exposing our progeny to by what we dump down the drain and what we let run off, you know, our driveway into the gutter.
Right.
We're more careful about it.
And we're more careful. And at the same time, even whatever your nationality is or the mixture of it, when you get your DNA tested to see who you really are in humanity, I definitely know that once the equipment's there, the ramen and that, you'll be able to see on the molecule what chemicals you were exposed to, I'm going to say ancestrally. Because a lot of times in these different cultures, if they wanted to move up the ladder or anything, you would get poisoned by a snake venom or arsenic or any of this stuff. And I think science is going to prove it very soon that plays a role in protecting your body and also creating more junk DNA. And this junk DNA could be not only from other lineage or anything, whether from here or above, But the thing is that through those changes, those mutations within your body that made you you, or the mutations within even your own natural gut flora, those enzymes, those changes that are in that junk DNA, I feel is going to be expressed. And many of the spraying and everything may be a way for trying to suppress the expression of that junk DNA or the true you.
You know, that's really a good point. I have people ask me from time to time about junk DNA. You know, does it have some metaphysical property that is not expressed in our society, or have we not been exposed to some galactic frequency for a long time, and so that DNA isn't used anymore? And they also bring up the question, you know, what is the chronic long-term effect of the toxicity in our environment on our current generation and on the next generation? And even if our country is doing a good job of trying to keep things clean, we're a small amount of the population in the world. If China is not doing a good job and India is not doing a good job, doesn't that affect us as well?
It affects the world. It affects the world, especially like what we've had with the Gulf spill and everything. It's affecting the world. What happened in Japan, and they're still living with it, you know, with Fukushima. It's affecting the world. You go as a foreign dignitary to that area, and you see, or you go to meetings, and then you become ill afterwards. Radiation poisoning does affect you. You do lose your hair 3 weeks later and stuff like that. But it's globally making a change. To put it like summary, we have radiation coming from Japan. It hit the West Coast. It hit 5 days after that incident occurred, the whole world, by the plume going around the world. You have the Gulf. You had former sprayings of the malathions, et cetera, predisposing your nervous system, getting you geared up for something. At the same time, you have individuals that can't metabolize now. We have the super obese people that either metabolism or malformed fat or whatever the multiple environmental stress factors that are occurring causing the change. But at the same time, with your junk DNA or any of this, maybe that is going to be the thing that separates you to survival and non-survival. At the same time, I'm going to tell you, many people, no matter what the disease is, whatever happened to them, it was their internal will to survive that took them to survival.
Do you think this plethora of junk DNA that we have in our genome is a reservoir from which we draw metaphysical strength?
I would think so. I think a higher spirituality. I think the answers are there. We just may not be able to interpret it at this time. But maybe through events in time, or what we're going to experience in a couple of days, maybe it will unfold. And that I'll give you a prime example. I had my genes tested, and I was always raised Lithuanian. My father's side was German, my mother's side Lithuanian, etc. I end up coming back with 67 different nations, even ancient Scythian, ancient military elite assassin Olmec warrior. I was amazed. I even had a little touch of Ojibwe. So I have a Mohawk partner. I said, hey, am I eligible for a tribal card? Okay. It wasn't, because no one ever got genetic testing. It was done by the bloodlines. Even if you had red hair, it was done by the bloodlines. You could be Mohawk or whatever. Okay. But the thing is, what was very interesting in this, my highest titer was 845, okay? I had 21 here, 13 here, 100 and some of these others, of these total 67 nations. I had another patient that got the same test. I had 21 Basque. My highest titer was 1,000, and turnaround, his was 136,000 for Basque. So I called the lab, and I asked the lab, I said, why does my patient have 137,000 as his highest titer, and my highest titer is 1,000? If I add them all up together, I don't even get 137 for his one allele. And the lab director said, well, Dr. Stanninger, you apparently have a lot of junk DNA.
Well.
So I don't know, but I think time will tell, and even individuals will know what their cosmic heritage will do, you know, because it's very interesting because new stars create far infrared, and out of that frequency, maybe that's the essence of who we are as we are our own star, that speck of creation.
Hmm. I've often thought about that, too, especially doing some of the astronomical research that we've done, that we've listened to on this program, that the solar system itself is getting into a neighborhood we don't see very often, maybe once every 26,000 years. And so all of the living beings on this planet are being bathed not just with the energy that comes from our sun, also the energy that comes from our galaxy. And some of them are very concentrated around the galactic plane, which seem to be nearing at this time. And maybe DNA that's in the genome has a reaction to some of the frequencies that we just don't see.
Right, and it's not just the frequency. Remember, our body forms from a single cell, which is that the ovum. And that single cell, when it's hit with the sperm, it combines that DNA, but to make your nose or your cheeks different from my cheeks or anything, yes, it's that heritage, but it's the measurement of the amount of sound and light, phono and photon, to make that curve or that little dimple in your chin or any of this. It's there. It's written on the cosmos. It's even where prayer, you know, where you should have a cleft palate, but all your relatives prayed for you and you didn't have the cleft palate. Those miracles do occur. And for anyone to say they're not, they just haven't seen it in their life or be open with their heart. And with this event, as you're saying, like on December 21st, that event occurred where our galaxy, the Milky Way, our sun, and that whole center of our galaxy goes through another portion of our the whole solar system out there. And at the same time, we're right at that zero point. And maybe that's when our sun, as a colleague of mine said, a blue light will come from the sun. And maybe that blue frequency will of that photons and those light, that mixture, blue light, will change or activate some of our ancient genes and ancient cosmos junk DNA. Who knows? But we'll know in a couple days.
That's
you know?
True.
I'm a very optimistic person. Everyone can paint a thing of doom. It's very well to be prepared. It's very good to think positive thoughts. And it is very hard to reason with someone that doesn't even think like you or is open to you and that. So don't argue with them. Just get above it because it's all going in a forward pace, but it truly unfolds. And I don't know if you'll agree with me, Dr. Agnew, but it truly unfolds when you're ready for it to unfold. And sometimes we go through these disasters, we go through wars, we go through all these other things of life and humanity, and it's where you, the individual, or the last representative of your family, or the last of your ancestors that is maybe enlightened, even if it's just a little speck of hope, that enlightenment and say, hey, I'm sorry we had to do all this or any of this events, that you can take it further than what your ancestors couldn't take.
Sure. One of the things that I think is most, you talk about enlightenment, it's not that rare of a thing to see in scientists, but it takes a little longer for us for the cosmic light to go off because we're so fact-driven just by nature of our science.
But every one of us on this planet, whoever our souls are, or whoever we are lean to or part of, we're all going to experience being here for that 26,000-year anniversary. It's like what happened on December 3rd, where we had three planets over the Giza pyramids, which was Mercury, Venus, and Saturn. And the thing is, that event only happens every 2,737 years. We had another event that happened 14,000 years, meaning in this whole year, the year 2012, many astrological events have occurred just in this one year. And I think that's amazing that I'm part of it, you're part of it, and our listening audience is part of it.
Absolutely.
Let alone all the rest of the world.
I don't think there's any coincidence that approximately 7 billion of us are alive on this planet at this time when the solar system is going to spend approximately 3 hours in the galactic plane on December 21st, 2012. All the prophets in the world and all the prognosticators in the world can say, oh, nothing's going to happen, everything's going to be fine on December 22nd, 2012. You'll see. Well, that might be so, but that doesn't change the cosmological fact that this solar system is going to be exposed to a set of frequencies and energetic particles and even gravitational waves that we only see for 3 or 4 hours every 26,000 years. It is a remarkable event.
Right, and we're all part of it, and we're going to see it.
Yes. Now, one of the questions I want to ask you before you go. The human consciousness, the soul that's inside of our biological transducer, I call it, your human body, we're all part of the environment that the genes and the genome is exposed to, not to mention the air and the water and the food and things like that, that we consume. How much is the person involved in the health and well-being of the body itself?
Well, there's people that coast and they'll take a pill and think that's going to help them versus people that become aware of their body and aware of their body and its connection. You can have a beautiful heart but just not have your mind connected in taking care of yourself. But that's the whole thing, and maybe this enlightenment that'll happen in a few days, maybe it's going to truly align your body and your heart together and your mind and be one within the universe. That would be a beautiful thing, so that you'd be conscious and aware so that you wouldn't be doing harm to your body.
Well, maybe it would be a beautiful thing that all the millions of souls around just look up at that moment, midnight, noon, or whatever this perfect time is. They will just lay their guns down and go home.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Dr. Agnew, but I heard basically what you said, but I don't know if you asked me a question because of the connection.
I didn't really make a question. I just made it maybe exposed to this sort of control delete frequency be exposed will cause everyone to just lay things down and go home. I know you're having a hard time. We've had technical difficulties all on the internet. Dr. Hildy, I really appreciate you coming on the program. I've enjoyed it. I would love to be a guest on your program. We need to do this again.
I appreciate it very much, and also I've asked Shoshana to send to you a reference to the Baileys for any of your listening audience from the desk of Dr. Hildy and Dr. Hildegard Stadinger. And the thing is that there's other information on that particular area. So you just plug in from the desk of Dr. Hilde on any search engine, and you'll be able to get it. A lot of other information, too.
Wonderful. We will link all of that at the website. So appreciate you coming on the program.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate it. And God bless to all of your audience. Happy holidays, and may all of us share in a very happy event, okay?
Okay. Thank you. We'll talk to you another time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, I apologize for the sound quality tonight. Sometimes the internet will comply, and sometimes it won't. That's just one of the wonders of live radio. One of the things in the news I wanted to cover, just felt it was inappropriate to do with our guest because she was so cheerful and so amazing informed and gave us all that wonderful information. We heard today on the news that HSBC, one of the world's largest banks, was busted for laundering billions in Mexican drug cartel money. I guarantee that this was not billions in marijuana money. It was cocaine and heroin. Now, where does heroin come from? It comes from Afghanistan. Who is guarding growing, manufacturing, transportation of heroin for the biggest drug lords the world has ever known, the Taliban? You got it. The U.S. military and NATO. HSBC, by the way, was not prosecuted. They were merely fined, which is a code word for taxed. A measly $1.92 billion that will be discounted, I'm sure, to about $100 million. It is suspected that this money will go straight into the support budget for the very military that is responsible for the production of the drug money that was being laundered in the first place. Does anybody out there believe that sequestration is going to make a dent in the funding being used by the military to conduct these drug, weapon, and money laundering operations around the world? I don't. If you, we have about 5 minutes left. If you want to get a thought in on this, our phone number anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else? On planet or off planet, it's 530-413-9537. I thoroughly enjoyed having Dr. Hilde on the program, and I appreciate her intellect, her spirit, her wonderful demeanor, and her wealth of information. Anyway, it's about 10:51. I wanted to step outside the planet just for a moment. There's a NASA mission under construction right now to launch 4 special satellites as a system of ships to detect X points in near Earth locations. These X points were discovered accidentally with the 2009 Themis mission. If you'll remember reading about it in the books, it was launched to search for the origin of the auroras. The article published claimed that the cosmic bullet, which was an unexplained explosion that popped out of empty space and resulted in an aurora, it was kind of a lame explanation, I thought. The real indication, according to this new article, is that there was a portal that opened for a moment at that spot. Now, NASA is suspecting that ships may be coming and going from Earth using these portals, and they're not from around here. So Jack Scudder, who's at NASA, and his team of researchers at the University of Iowa have found X points in the Earth's magnetosphere using this Themis satellite. The openings allow charged solar particles to be conducted in the planet's upper atmosphere. Dave Seibeck, professor with Goddard Space Flight Center, explained in 2008 that 10 years ago I was pretty sure they didn't exist, but now the evidence is incontrovertible. X points, which have been seen from NASA spacecraft, are now the focal point of future missions of study to assert more detail. Scudder believes he has found a way to detect them by examining decades-old NASA data from the Polar spacecraft, which was launched way back in 1996. It remains in orbit around Earth despite its decommissioning in 2008. Scudder thinks using Polar data, we have found five simple combinations of magnetic field and energetic particle measurements that tell us when we've come across an X point or an electron diffusion region. A single spacecraft properly instrumented can make these measurements. X points form when angling lines of magnetic force from the sun and Earth join to create the actual portals. The term X points are where the crisscross of these magnetic fields occurs. It's possible that these might be dimensional openings. Could be interesting to see how it all works out. We'll talk about it again next week. We'll be live on the 21st right here on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of tonight's program. We'll see you next week on X Squared Radio.